morning, everybody. I'm going to echo a few things Shane said. Christina couldn't make it because the Army reduced funding, so he said several of us are self-funded to be here, so that's me as well. Also, to echo what he said where he works is like the CDC of the Army, where I work is like the NIH of the Army. I work at the Walter Reed Army Institute of Research, and my group, the Center for Military Psychiatry and Neuroscience, you could call the NIMH of the Army, essentially. And so we work, and my group in particular, the military psychiatry branch, we do a lot of large-scale studies, epidemiologic studies, as well as clinical interventions. So this comes from one of our epidemiologic studies. And I'll be talking about aggressive behaviors and binge drinking from OEF, soldiers who return from OEF. No disclosures to present. All right, so first I'll talk about aggressive behaviors, the background for that amongst soldiers, and then on to binge drinking and then the relationship between the two in the literature. So we know, looking at various aggressive behaviors, we know that they're pretty common following deployment from some of our previous work. Depending on the behavior, 18 to 43% of soldiers are engaging in aggressive behaviors in the past months. But a lot of those have been looking at it within the context of post-traumatic stress disorder or how it relates to combat exposures. And it's really important to look at this because we know aggressive behaviors obviously could have an impact on health if they get into a physical fight. And professionally and personally, there could be strong implications as well of aggressive behavior. Looking at binge drinking, it's also been a serious problem in the military, and the prevalence has increased pretty dramatically over time. If you look at the prevalence from 1998, it was just over a third, still high. But if you look at 2008, you're talking almost half had a binge drinking problem. So that's very high in general and much higher than the civilian counterparts. So then just looking at a few studies where those two concepts have been looked at in the association between alcohol and aggression, there was a study that looked at Vietnam veterans and did show an association between alcohol abuse and aggression with more recent soldiers that are more recently in the military. There was an association between alcohol addiction and aggression levels with a dose-response relationship. And then finally, I guess this is your study. I'm seeing Galloway. I'm like, oh, I know that guy. So I'm realizing, so this must have been a Shane study that he just published. Soldiers with a positive screen for alcohol misuse reported higher levels of physical aggression, and he could probably tell us a lot more about that. So the goals of this study are to look at the relationship between the two, binge drinking and aggressive behaviors, controlling for PTSD and combat exposure to see if there was still a link between those two variables. So first looking at the prevalence of binge drinking and aggressive behaviors in a post-deployment sample, and then looking at the association of those two, controlling for well-known correlates. All right, so our survey came last summer, July 2011, and we looked at a brigade combat team that had come home 3 months prior from Afghanistan, and there were 2,420 soldiers that met our criteria, which was that they had deployed, and I guess also responded to the questions that we were looking at. So 75% response rate refers to those who were available to take our survey. So a lot of people were on temporary duty elsewhere, sick, in some other class that they had to be at, some training. So 75% of the people in the brigade were available to take our survey. Of those, 94% said that they were willing, consented to take this, to have their data used for research. So our measure for aggressive behavior comes from an article from 1990 by Kolka et al., and it asks about four particular behaviors and how often you did those in the past month. So how often did you get angry with someone and yell or shout at them, get angry with someone and kick or smash something, threaten someone with violence, or getting into a fight and hitting the person, so increasing levels of severity in the aggression. And we looked at it both how often have you done it, as well as did you do it, period, yes or no. So we had both of those data. We focused here on the yes-no dichotomous version. Did you do one of these behaviors in the last month? We also looked at the audit C, which is a common measure of alcohol misuse, and we looked at one particular item associated with binge drinking. How often do you have six or more drinks on one occasion? And those are the response options there. If they said they were using six or more drinks on one occasion, monthly or more, that met the criteria for binge drinking. We also looked at demographic variables from our survey, age, gender, rank, and marital status, And then we looked at post-traumatic stress disorder. So we asked all the questions of the PCL on this larger survey, and then we looked at those items that meet each of the criteria. Did they fit with the categories that you would use in the DSM? So one intrusion symptom, three avoidance symptoms, two hyperarousal symptoms, at the moderate level, and then a total score of 50 or above on that PCL, which is a fairly conservative measure of PTSD. And that's we people have used that in previous studies in our from our group before and other military researchers to say they would meet screening criteria. We can't diagnose PTSD, of course, it's just a survey, but they would probably meet screening criteria if they were to go in. And then we also had a combat exposure scale that's been culled over time through a lot of our surveys, other people's surveys. So there's 28, and this is, I think Shane was probably using some of the same stuff earlier. So 28 different experiences of combat, anything ranging from I witnessed the death of an American soldier to I saw somebody blown up. I evacuated, or I went into houses and looked for enemy combatants. So there's a various list of 28 exposures. And you could say up, you know, 0, 1, 2, 3, 4, or 5 or more. We just dichotomized it. Did you have this experience or not? And then we summarized it. So of the 28 experiences, how many did you have? The low is 0 to 9 experiences, moderate 10 to 19. And then high combat exposure was 20 to 28 experiences, so experiencing nearly all of them. So here's our sample demographics. The left-hand column is the entire sample. The right-hand column are those who reported binge drinking. All right, so first thing I want to point out at the very bottom there, the prevalence of binge drinking in this population was 35%. So about that one-third of the soldiers reporting drinking 6 or more drinks at one time in the past month. So other things to know, let me go back. Other things to notice, so if you look at the binge drinkers, they are younger, slightly more likely to be junior enlisted, male, the whole sample's pretty much male, so not much of a difference there, less likely to be married, a little bit more likely to have PTSD, and a little bit more likely to have more combat exposure. We didn't run statistical analyses on those differences, but you can just sort of see the differences there. All right, so this scale looks at the prevalence of aggressive behaviors. Your left hand, your y-axis is the percent that did each of these behaviors once or more in the past month. The x-axis is each of the types of behaviors. The light blue bar is the entire sample, and the darker blue bar are those who reported binge drinking. So looking at the first set of behaviors, any aggressive behaviors. So this was that they endorsed any of the four behaviors: shouting, kicking or smashing, threatening, or actually getting into a fight. Pretty large percentage, just something to note. We're talking 70% of the soldiers are reporting some aggressive behavior in the past month, so that's pretty high. But that does include getting mad and shouting, so it's somewhat of a low level of aggressive behavior when you think of it like that. But then you can see as you go up in the level of aggression, it goes down in the prevalence, down to 9% of the total sample getting into a fight. But you can also see some pretty dramatic differences for the binge drinkers, and each of these are statistically different from one another. So the binge drinkers in every scenario were significantly more likely to have an aggressive to conduct these aggressive behaviors. All the way down to getting into fights, those who binge drink, 1 in 6, if you can see here, 1 in 6 has gotten into a fight in the last month, which is pretty dramatic if you think about actually physically getting into a fight. In the orange text at the bottom, this was just an overall. So 6% of the sample had done all four of these in the past month. 10% of those who had been binge drink, I guess would be the way to say that, had 10% of those had been drink in the past month. All right, so then this is our multiple regression analysis. So this looks at combat exposure, PTSD, binge drinking, as well as demographics, all in one model. And we have the first two behaviors on this slide, and then I'll come to the second two behaviors on the next slide. So first, looking at shouting and yelling or kicking and smashing something after getting angry with someone. All right, so we see PTSD, even accounting for all of this, is associated with aggressive behaviors, which we've shown in the literature previously. Pretty strong relationships, 2.4 and 3.0 for the odds ratios. Looking at combat exposure, again, as you'd expect, strong relationships here, particularly if you were in the high exposure group. But even controlling for those, binge drinking is still almost a 2x odds here for predicting aggressive behavior, even when you account for all these other demographics, PTSD, and combat exposures. Similarly, when you look at the two more severe behaviors, threatening someone with violence or actually getting into a fight, PTSD is strongly associated. The high exposure to combat, not moderate, just the high exposure associated with these behaviors. And binge drinking, pretty strongly associated, 2.5 times and 2 times the odds for both of those. All right, so looking at our discussion for all of our results, the prevalence of binge drinking is 35%, and it's significantly associated with engaging in aggressive behaviors, even when you control for other known correlates, and particularly high for threatening and getting into fights, over 2 times odds for both of those. A couple of limitations on our study. These data are cross-sectional and self-reported, so there may be a bias in their self-reporting. Like the survey Shane mentioned, very good anonymization, our way of anonymizing it, we tell them to, each state gets a code, and what state were you in 9/11, multiplied by your last 4 of your Social Security, and you get a unique PIN that way. So it would be pretty hard to lock people in that way. So they should feel pretty good about it being anonymous, but still there could be a bias based on the self-reporting of these dicier behaviors. Data may also be underreported. The other interesting piece is the audit lists 6 or more drinks for binge drinking, but the general standard CDC and other places typically use 5 or more drinks, as opposed to 6 or more drinks, but that was what we had in the data. Like Dr. McFarland said later on, you go, oh, we wish we had 5 or more, but we just have 6 or more from this, and so that may actually underestimate binge drinking in this sample. So in conclusion, we found there is an association with alcohol and aggression, which is consistent with the literature, and there is an independent effect of binge drinking on aggressive behavior above and beyond these other typical associations that we see. And this could have severe ramifications for soldiers, UCMJ violations, which is the Criminal Code of Justice. Jail time could be associated with domestic abuse, lower unit morale, which we saw was really important previously. And so it may be helpful to treat soldiers for both anger and alcohol use, misuse concurrently, and also to find a way to target soldiers who are at risk for binge drinking, because they may not be showing up in a drug prevention program. They may not be a consistent, regular drinker to show up in one of these ASAP-type programs, but they are periodically drinking a heck of a lot, which is contributing possibly to aggressive behaviors. So finding other ways to target those soldiers will be important. Thank you.
Speakers can still come up. If I could ask all of you just to move down 1 seat. And I'm going to bring 1 chair up here so everybody can sit up.
Boy, this is a true test of the moderator.
Small room pose challenges in many respects.
I'll just stand. That's fine. I'm a managed care psychiatrist, so I get kind of restless after about 15 minutes anyway. I'm trying to get up and say, bring in the new patient.
So I'm really good at sitting. Okay, so questions for moderator? Yes.
The first and the third presentation were from Army research units. Is there anything comparable for Guard and Reserve that would do the same kind of research? Because it seems like all of the questions are as relevant to Guard and Reserve as they are to active duty. Is there comparable research centers or something?
Yes.
Go ahead.
Yes. The good news is yes. So this particular wave of data that I reported was just active duty, but we've done similar waves of data with National Guard soldiers previously and published some on that. And interestingly, maybe not so surprisingly, when they first get home, their mental health looks the same, but after about a year, Guard soldiers' mental health actually looks a good bit worse. And I can talk to you afterwards. We're actually starting an intervention program now to work on, specifically with the Guard, to try to prevent those problems.
Question for Shane. Are you at Dietrich or Aberdeen?
Aberdeen Group.
Aberdeen, okay. And so it seems like there's an issue with transition for married or significant other folks. But, I mean, what is a good transition? If they're not having a good transition, like if a good transition is A, B, and C, I mean, what is the problem? Why are they not getting A, B, and C? I mean, you define a good transition as, you know, the family still loves them,
okay,
they have a job, they have
right,
a set of friends. I mean, I don't know how you define transition as good or bad. bad. I mean, it seems like transition is always bad because
right.
humans don't want to change.
Yeah, right.
You know? So yeah. it's still a little fuzzy to me, really, what the issue is and how we fix it.
Yeah, and I think that's a good point. I think we don't quite know how to, I don't know if we could define a good transition for anyone, which is why we ask it so subjectively, just kind of, do you think you're getting a good transition? I think what the Army tends to focus on is ensuring that people are getting adequate resources, whatever they need, you know, either it's mental health or it's simple things like financial and checkbook management. I think that's a good question. I don't know that I could define it.
That's a really good question. I mean, data-wise, I don't know that we have data to ask that. Anecdotally, they'll say getting back into the swing of things would be your, if you had a, you know, just feeling like your things are, you know, going similarly well to where they were before you left, be it with work, marriage, you know, like you said, finances, feeling like you're, you know, as close to normal as you can be. But yeah, I don't think we have data to specify.
And the services, you know, I'm sure most of you in this room, you know that, so when they come back, they do what's called a post-deployment health assessment immediately. And then there's known issues with it, you know, they do it as they're coming back from theater. So then the Army and the DOD started doing it post-deployment reassessment, 90 days, because they realized that, you know, people just want to get back home and get into things, and they're always thinking, okay, you know, this is probably normal, I'll be okay. And then 90 days, people are starting to realize, okay, this isn't quite normal. And so I think the Army recognized, or everyone recognized, I say the Army because I work for the Army, but I'm talking about all the services. You know, there's a recognition that that transition is a prolonged period of time, you know, 90 to 120 days, a very critical period. So we did this around the time they came back, but I think your question is great because I think transition is such a long period of time, and if that 120-day period is probably where we need to be asking the question, because what may seem normal when you come back and you think that I just need to get out of fifth gear is going to go away. You don't get out of fifth gear, and that's part of the problem that our soldiers are dealing with.
Well, I mean, I'll give you an example. I
sure.
live in San Antonio, so I mean, I see this all the time.
Yes.
But, you know, somebody suggested to me that I consider this wounded warrior for a job. So I said, okay, let's have lunch. Let me see your resume. I've got a position. It's kind of, we'll just call it logistics.
Sure.
So he gives me his resume. He's been out 4 years. And it says IED analyst. You know, and I was like, well, I mean, to be honest with you, there may not be a ton of IED analyst jobs in the future. Have you thought about branching out your resume to just use words like logistics or management or whatever? And he's like, what? Why would I do that? I was like, and you've been out 4 years. He goes, well, at Fort Sam Houston, you know, they have a resume person, and I need to see the job description before I can fix my resume. So I'm like, to me, after 4 years, that's not a transition. That
sure.
is,
right.
No,
that's
yeah.
not good enough.
Right.
Yeah.
You have a question?
Yeah. Robert Petrick at West Haven is divided up social support into family and friends versus perceptions of community support. Mm-hmm. And it's found they're both effective for decreasing PTSD and suicidal ideation. Have you looked at community support?
In this one, we didn't. We had another study that we're doing specifically with warriors in transition, and we used a more appropriate scale that looks at I think there's a scale of 9 items and asked specifically about, you know, social support from family, friends, community. And we did see differences in the warriors in transition where there were significant differences. But it's a very unique population because it's a hospitalized population. In a normal, you know, a normal general population of soldiers, we haven't looked at it in that much detail. Typically, our surveys and research is more reactive. In other words, we're being asked to come there to do something, and so usually it's kind of a very quick, specific survey of what they're looking for, and we don't have the option of including a lot of things that, you know, like more complex social support surveys. So we should see more in the warriors, but we haven't in a more general population. So that's a great idea.
On that same question, I should know this because I have these variables, but I haven't looked at them. On the social support, is it friends specified, like friends back home versus friends in the military, or do you just say friends?
I think it's friends.
Friends, okay.
And it typically asks, that specific scale that I'm talking about, asks them to quantify it. So it'll ask them to list from like 0 to 9 or something like that. 9 is the top end, and then you can calculate kind of how big their network is and break it into categories.
And similarly, building on that, I'm a community psychologist and I'm now a postdoc at the VA, so
So I thought, thanks for your study, I thought the positive focus was really nice, actually. And, you know, we try to sort of look at the existing strengths and build on those for interventions. And I'm wondering what you're thinking about in terms of intervention possibilities based on your results, because I thought the cohesion part was really interesting.
Yeah.
And how that lasts over time.
I think definitely in the work we've done, we've had a very hard time getting access to families. Even though it's very, you know, I think yesterday I heard a talk where, you know, getting access to families is difficult. And we actually don't even do research. We come in, you know, the unit asks us to come there. But even still, we try to do focus groups with families. But I think definitely including as much of the family into every single point. A lot of units are trying to do that now where the day a soldier checks into the unit, they ask him for his wife's phone number and they want to call him. And I know at Fort Stewart they're doing that. That's one example. And a lot of soldiers are offended by that, though. So a lot of soldiers, they want to leave the installation at 4 o'clock or 5 or 6 or 7, and they want to actually have a life outside of the installation. So it's a fine line. But I think, you know, as much as you can include, not just wives, because half the people aren't married, you know, trying to establish, though, that contact list, that numbers of people, and so that, you know, units can keep in contact with families and friends. And, you know, usually they call them FRG and FRSAs, family readiness groups, family readiness support groups. They're very strong while units are deployed. But when they're in garrison, they just aren't. They don't function as well because families don't perceive there as being a big a need, but there's always lots of things going on in the unit. And so a lot of units now are developing programs for spouses and significant others that involve them in various aspects. I know another unit that has like a spouse's warrior program where they go to classes and they learn different things about the unit. So I think as much as they can engage family and friends in different activities in garrison, the better. Because the one thing we've been trying to push is more of a prevention versus response, because soldiers have multiple issues. You know, there's this range from prevention to treatment. When a soldier gets to the treatment end where they're suicidal or they have major depression, that's probably not the only thing they're dealing with. They're dealing with multiple issues. But in the prevention realm, when things start to, if we can target things earlier, then there's less stigma and barriers attached to it. You know, if I just have a financial problem, I might go see, you know, someone about how to help with that. But once I have a financial issue and I'm having problems at home and now I have anxiety and a combat reaction, how do you even deconstruct that to treat it? That's the problem right now with treatment. So I think it's as much as they can involve the family so that there's recognition. Soldiers are, you know, soldiers are learned to, you know, not take a knee and focus on themselves. Just they're worried about the guy next to them. So as much as they can get someone to recognize those issues, the better.
Can I just speak to three specific programs? So one, you may have heard the term battle mind for some of you who have been involved in Army. It's not an okay term anymore. But there's spouse battle mind. Mm-hmm. So there is a program that's being implemented more and more for spouses that's prevention-oriented. What will the transition look like? You know, what's it going to be like when your husband comes home? What are the warning signs to look for? So that is out there getting implemented. I don't know how quickly or how effusively, but it exists. There are two new programs that I can speak to because I'm very involved in them, that for soldiers specifically, one for active component and one for guard, to go to what you're saying. So the active component, we are currently, actually just last week, we collected our second wave of data on a program, Army SMART, Stress Management and Army and Resilient Training. So the concept being when units come home from a high combat deployment, 3 months out, like Shane mentioned, about 3 months out, they would receive a kind of intensive intervention program. The whole unit would get together. So a platoon would all receive this training, and it teaches all kinds of mental health skills. You frame it in a resilience prevention program. You don't say you're getting CBT. But it's like mindfulness, CBT, other kinds of things. So, and it focuses on the unit as a whole, the unit's strength, so it plays to that unit cohesion. So cross your fingers that it was a randomized control trial with group level, so hopefully our groups fit better than the control group. And then if so, we're going to push that out with behavioral health providers throughout the Army. And then we're just starting for a guard unit, even more specifically to focus on unit cohesion, because we think what's happening with guard units is they come home, they go back to the civilian world, and they have very little tie to anything. The FRG that Shane referred to is much worse, anecdotally, from the guard soldiers, anecdotally, I can't speak research-wise,
But so we're working on intervention to specifically address how to stay in touch with your unit even when you're dispersed everywhere else, thinking that that might buffer some of the results of being in the guard.
Thank you. So I have a couple questions, mostly regarding spouses. Yep. I want you to feel left out. you guys, I think, I'm not telling you anything you don't know, that there's a connection between these two lines of inquiry, that the role of the spouse in the troop's health, but also there's a reciprocal relationship between the returning troop's health, mental health, and the spouse's health. Mm-hmm. We know that, mm-hmm. and then their children as well. So I'm trying to figure out why there's no, speaking of cohesion, or sort of integration in. I interpret what you're saying as trying to involve spouses in helping the soldier reintegrate. Mm-hmm. But who is helping the spouse cope with the soldier's reintegration difficulty? I don't know that there's a specific answer to this, but they're so linked to that. But my really minor question is, you said earlier that the cost for mental health for the military wives was not an issue. Who covers their costs?
Well, if I could clip.
They don't have access to the same kind and length and duration of care that their spouses do. We know that. And then I'm also really interested in not just the spouse's mental health, but how it affects the children of military children, which is a really long-term effect.
Yeah. So it sounds like part of the question was the cost. It's interesting, psychiatrists always talk about money, and researchers talk about health and well-being and so forth. So now I'm in my comfort zone here. Yeah. We had a number of other items in the survey, and I didn't bore you with them, about access issues. One is geography. We had a large contingent of folks married to troops in the Guard or Reserve, and they were in rural areas, as it turns out, many more than I would have guessed, 50 miles from a major city and so forth. So it's a kind of personal cost. If you're interested in face-to-face services, you got to drive an hour's worth to get somewhere. But in terms of dollars, we also had some finance-type questions, and in a focus groups, the military system for the wives, the TRICARE system, did not get very good evaluation, shall we say. And speaking as a TRICARE provider, I can certainly echo that sentiment. Hugely complex, confusing, providers don't get paid, et cetera, et cetera. So I think in terms of costs, some of our participants told us that they gave up on TRICARE and just ended up paying out of pocket. Compared to the civilian sector, cost was not as big a concern for the military-wise, but it wasn't zero either. If 20% of them said they didn't have the bucks.
And are they relying on civilian providers?
I think in our data, one of the issues was I think we have a little bit of overrepresentation of Guard and Reserve. So these folks were in rural areas, and they were really far from a base, so they couldn't get to a military. They could get to a military hospital, but an hour, 90 minutes or so driving one way. So they were kind of perforce trying to make do with the civilian sector. And you're right, and that's a theme that came out very clearly in the focus groups, that civilian providers, not very familiar with these issues, to say the least.
And also, I want to add something to that. A couple years ago, the VA did start on a women's health initiative, really in the union search to support practice. So I know that targeted, especially for women, veterans, but also really supposed to extend to YANO.
And that's the Women's Health Initiative?
Yeah.
They're doing research, or they've started research.
It's research.
So
link back to factors, and then also beyond.
Hi, I'm Diane Patton from the Uniformed Services University, and I've actually conducted four studies with military spouses. And so I have a lot that I could share with you. They're stressed, obviously.
Yes.
They do have some coping mechanisms that they use that are more beneficial than others. I think that this whole discussion, totally agree that for the transition, the reintegration, we really need to be thinking about the family, the unit, because that's how it all works together. You can't study them even in isolation because this one has a problem, but, you know, I mean, that's kind of the unknown. I mean, that's the known. The other thing, the gentleman that talked about community, I think that's also a really important fact, but what's also important to know is that most of the military families don't live like on the installation, only 10 to 15% of them do. So they're out in communities, and there are a variety of communities. And so depending on where they live, and then the National Guard and the Reserves, they have their community, but yet they don't have the linkage back to the active component. So it's a multifaceted problem that everybody in this room is interested in studying, and so it's like, how do we get all of it together? I just wanted to share that.
And I think, you know, talking about the families, I'll tell you one thing that very recently the Surgeon General of the Army and the Vice Chief of Staff there, and they went on this whirlwind tour. And they came back with, I think, five or six major themes, and one of them was families and spouses and healthcare. And so they've got all these new initiatives rolled in, and for a couple of years now, there was something called the Comprehensive Soldier Fitness. Well, they're going to change that to where that's going to become Comprehensive Soldier Fitness and Families, CSF2. So they're changing that to rope in the families in that, and then they're also roping in the families into what's going to become the Resilient and Readiness Campaign, which are things that are being pushed, and I know the Army, I don't know all the other services, from the highest level. So there's a renewed emphasis, and they recognize this too, because as the change in the theater of operations and more soldiers are coming back, I think they recognize that, you know, the next big issue on the horizon is going to become, if it isn't already, you know, that interaction and families and whatnot. So there is a recognition and there is a renewed emphasis on those from the high levels of Army leadership.
Question right here, because I feel like when we're talking about transition, I mean, there's people from Vietnam still transitioning.
Right.
I mean,
yeah.
Transition is a
long.
It's not, I mean, I know the 100 days is maybe somewhat, you know, you get some indicators, but, you know, there's delayed onset. I feel like this transition is going to go on.
Hi, my name is Rachel Gaddis from WestSat, and I wanted to speak to the community piece. I was just involved in a study with the Institute of Medicine that was looking at the impacts of multiple deployments on communities,
okay.
And we went out and met with the Chamber of Commerce, with the, you know, fire police chiefs, school boards, and we went to, I think, 7 military dense communities, and that study is going to be published in a couple of months, but it's going to have some best practices on the community level, off post of what can be done in with linking services and making sure that people, if they live off base, that there is a lot of stigma, that they're still getting access to the services that they need. And I had a question for you about your presentation. Did you control or have any measure for unit effects? It was just within one unit. So what type of culture might there be within that unit that might contribute to?
So the unit is the brigade. I mean, so at some point, that's a very, very large unit to be talking about. And you're talking about, you know, 3,000, 4,000 soldiers, as he mentioned. So even within that, then you're talking about battalions and companies and platoons. So I think, I could be wrong, but you don't see that large of an effect at the brigade level.
Okay.
Definitely when you get drilled down into companies, platoons, they definitely have more of a, you know, a pride and a spirit that you might see differences. But, and we didn't look at it. We have that level of data. We could look at nested data, and we do sometimes. But I don't, for these larger survey, for this kind of question, probably you wouldn't see any large effect. And generally these brigades, which is also the level that Shane was at, are fairly representative of not necessarily the whole Army, but at least a combat maneuver type units, pretty representative of that.
All right. Brian Manning, Dallas Air Force Base. I actually work base level public health, and one of the things that I am in charge of doing is the DRAs.
What does that stand for?
DRA Deployment Resiliency Assessment. And so there's a DRA 1 through 5. We do it over 18 months after they come back and once before they leave. So my question is we have 1.1 deployments on our base. So people are leaving before they're back before they're gone again. And that's our deployment tempo. We deploy thousands of troops that way, and we never get them all the way through the DRA process before they come home. So is there any looking into seeing how effective this program is, because we dump a lot of resources and military into it, to catch those people? And these guys, of course, every 2 months, they're in the office getting seen by somebody. The other one is we actually have a lot of resources out there as far as the Harriman Family Readiness Center gets free child care, free mental health, military one source, as well as a mental health program. There's a lot of resources out there to help the spouses and family cope with these things, but is there any studies as to the effectiveness of the military is communicating those to the people and how they can actually take advantage of resources that are there? So I can have two questions.
The DRA, I'm not even familiar with. I know that the...
Is it like the PDHA and the PDHRA for the
Army?
Yeah,
in the Air Force, it's all, we just lumped it all together and called it the DRA.
Okay.
Yeah. Yeah, I don't know much about it. I know that communication, it's funny, last summer when Rare was at Campbell doing a study, I shouldn't tell you guys where it was, but when they were in Kentucky doing their study, we were in Kentucky doing a different study because there was a lot of issues going on. And one of the big things we asked about was communication. How you found out about resources, how do you know what exists, what do you use, why do you use it? And so at one installation, we kind of delved into how they get their most information, and what we actually found was Facebook and the base website and then the base newspaper. So at an installation level, but as far as how it's communicated from, you know, Army levels and whatnot, I don't have the foggiest. I know that that was amongst soldiers who report that information. Of course, soldiers also will tell you that the way they get most of their information is from another soldier. So.
I don't know of any specific sanctioned study on, you know, do you know about A, B, C, D? Do you use A, B, C, D, at least as far as I know?
This question is for everybody up here and around the room. I think the one thing that I see and hear a lot is that there's a fear that if, when you access service for military wives and military members, that will affect the career of that military member. So do they really have an effect on their career? And also, what is being done to kind of remove that barrier for them?
So, frankly, I was really surprised to hear the result about the military wives thinking they have an impact on the husband's career. I'm a practitioner one day a week at Walnut Says the Naval. I don't think it would. But that's my own opinion. But I don't think this, I mean, I'm saddened to hear that because I really don't think the spouse's stuff would affect it. The soldiers, maybe. And the good news is there are barriers being removed right now. If there's one of the things that you would fill out your periodic assessment of your health, that you would do self-report. If you said if you've been treated for combat-related stressors or you've seen marital counseling, you can put no for this question. So that's helpful. But on the other hand, I think there is a concern about your security clearance would be one of the big pieces. If you have some kind of top secret clearance, I think there is a concern that you would lose that, which could definitely affect your career path, and I'm not sure that that is fully figured out yet.
Good. It doesn't directly impact it in that if you went to seek mental health, you're not going to not get promoted. However, if you're a military policeman and you go and you have depression, you get medication, well, then I have to take your weapon. You can't be on duty.
Right.
So, and then everybody else is going to be impacted by you not serving. So it's kind of a yes and a no.
Right.
And then the security clearance question has been changed to where if you say you have mental health, it doesn't revoke your clearance. However, if you are a substance abuser or your prescription, you know, and you have an addiction, that may. So it's always a yes and a no, and that's the conundrum when they're trying to reduce stigma and barriers.
Other questions?
Bethany, you might have said this, but how close in time were the women who responded to the survey to their spouses being deployed?
Well, the concrete answer there. I think we got that data somewhere in our database. For the majority, actually, if I'm recalling this correctly, or roughly half, I mean, the spouse was overseas. So, you know, coincident. But the other half, the spouse, the military member, had been home maybe, I'm vaguely recollecting, 6-12 months, something like that.
This isn't off topic, but I'll ask it anyway. I was at a presentation yesterday where someone spoke about people who had been dishonorably discharged due to actually, in many cases, it was behavior that was associated with PTSD and other mental health issues. And so my question was whether in the middle of all of this interest in assessing and coming up with programs and interventions for returning troops, if there's any consideration in changing, do you discharge somebody dishonorably because their behavior was related to a health condition? And is there any, do you know if there's any thought to changing that, those kinds of designations, which then, because you know when they're discharged dishonorably, then they're not entitled to VA.
Exactly.
So you're just speaking of public health, you make the problem so much worse because guarantee those are going to be the people that never get any care, as bad as people are at seeking care even through the VA. And so I mean, I know this is sort of out of your focus, but I just wondered if you've heard any, is there any discussion about an evidence-based proposal to change the policy?
I can only speak, this is tangentially related and I can't give you the details, but there was a paper, there was a 9/11 special issue of Lancet that came out, and one of the papers in there was about a prevention or an intervention program for ethical behaviors in the military, so
it's the people that make the decisions reading the Lancet.
Yeah. Probably because the people who wrote it, I mean, one of them is Lieutenant Colonel in the Army, and the other one's the chief neuropsychiatry consultant for the Surgeon General. So that those were the two authors. So probably is the answer to that.
Important, but I mean, I suppose it's important to scale up VA, which is the care.
I'm sorry, I believe we have a VA expert here. Can you speak a little louder?
Number in the room.
No? Okay, all right.
The person that gave the presentation said she had examples of people whose behavior was due to their PTSD.
I don't think you can extrapolate from case examples.
When people are discharged dishonorably, they do take into consideration the reason for the behavior? Do you know what the policy is?
I've been told.
Okay.
So I used to know this stuff. But I'm told that that the policy that is that if the behavior is attributable to the PTSD, it's a medical issue.
Okay, that's great to hear.
A dishonorable issue.
So
who knows in the individual case, right?
Right.
There's also a VA regulation, which is a puzzle that's never been used, that if VA determines that insanity is that if the behaviors related to dishonorable discharge were due to insanity, undefined, then VA can enroll the person in care in spite of. And I think that's ever been applied.
Yes, I'd like to take the conversation back to the left of the boom, because that's the interest of my organization. I work for a nonprofit in Alexandria, Samueli Institute. And so we're particularly interested in integrative approaches to kind of promoting resilience and to helping prevent the right of the room boom issues. And so I'm curious about the work that's being done right now with the kind of the mindfulness and the CBT combined program. And What kind of outcomes are you looking at specifically in that study?
Everything. So it's a 15-page survey that we gave before and after. Some of them are specific to the program, like are you able to, one of the big concepts in the program was this idea of pausing. You know, can you stop before you act? Can you just take a step back and decide, hey, think about your consequences that might come out of this? So there's some specific questions related to that, related to the idea of having your goals in the long run. Are you mindful? Can you think before you act? But then there's much broader questions like the ones that were on both of our surveys that we can also look at. Are there group differences for the people that receive this training? So I mean, everything from your relationship. You know, we have a survey. We used a lot of, like they were both mentioned, we used a lot of measures that are elsewhere in the literature that are validated. We put those onto our survey. So we have a relationship measure. We have an alcohol measure. We have a unit cohesion measure, PTSD. I mean, it's a long survey.
So you are looking at unit cohesion.
We have that.
Thinking of that ideal model. And so I'm curious, with an RCT type of approach, do you get buy-in from unit leaders to allow the implementation of a program in certain units, and then you have a wait list control? I mean,
survey only. We have an active control as well, which I didn't mention. We actually have an active control group, which comes from the Comprehensive Soldier Fitness, which Shane was just referring to, PrEP, which is this sort of sports psychology piece of things. So a third of our platoons got this sports psychology kind of motivation, goals, energy management thing. We had a survey only, and then we had our intervention program. So we actually have all three of those conditions.
Great. We're in the process of working with a Marine Corps base to evaluate a program that they're implementing. And so I'd love to kind of talk to you about replicating some of the measures, because I think this really kind of guides, you know, kind of the work that we can all do together. We don't reinvent the wheel as far as
which I think happens between services, unfortunately.
Right.
Yeah.
Right.
So any other questions? Can I ask one?
Go ahead.
For you, do you know if the whys in your survey were demographically similar to the whys across the services? 29 seemed somewhat old for an average age of the wife.
Yes. So the Defense Department demographic report focuses mostly on the troops, but there's also a chapter or two on the wives. And yeah, I think we're a little bit older, although not that much older. But get some time, we're going to have to compare our participants to the demographic data in the Defense Department demographic report.
The latest study that I did, I had 807 females, and the mean age was
29.8.
Hey,
all right.
Get that.
Yeah, really. Can I get your card?
And I used Facebook, and just like that, that's how I got all my participants.
Facebook is just astonishing.
Okay, so one last question here before we end the session. Thank you so much. And this is a question for Dr. McFarland or anyone else who might have experience with this. In the study that I was involved in, we had some difficulty and challenges, particularly with the spouses, parsing out stresses related to deployments and multiple deployments from just military lifestyle in general, and moving constantly and uprooting the kids and putting them in new schools and having to start a new job every time. So I'm wondering if you have any thoughts on that.
Well, we do have those data, and yeah, I think we're eventually going to try to look at sort of predictors of depression scores, multivariate modeling, and so forth. So the quick answer is I don't know if this morning, but somewhere down the road we may have that answer.
There are studies that have actually really, I can't remember the author of this one, but there are studies that have deliberately done comparisons of outcomes in families where they were all military families, but the deployment experience was different. Mm-hmm. So that would, there, some had had no history of deployment, some had less history of deployment than others, because they, and some of these were more studies of behavioral outcomes in children, but right. It was the same idea that are there the stresses in the household just from military lifestyle, moving a lot, and they addressed that issue quite extensively in the studies.
Yeah, specifically on that, yesterday I went to a talk that's apparently getting published in February in the American Journal of Preventive Medicine, so you can look for this, that looked at adolescents in a home of military-related families, and that it was the deployment specifically, that there wasn't, and for substance abuse,
specifically the paper was about adolescent substance use and the deployments in a dose response relationship, the number of deployments was affecting their likelihood to use substances, but not just being in a military home.
Okay. All right, well, I'd like to thank all of our speakers for a wonderful talk. And then a last special thanks to those of you in the room who are currently on active duty in the military and those of you who are veterans in the room. Thank you.